The order will call case number 84947-8519-58228, District Court v. Las Vegas Review-Journal v. District Court. They're all kind of mixed. You know who you are. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Maggie McCletchy for Las Vegas Review-Journal, Inc. Today we're here on the question of whether, despite the public interest in family court, and despite the fact that we have elected judges, the public can nonetheless be locked out of all family law proceedings and records, either automatically or upon simple request of a party. The proponents of secrecy are asking for this court to answer that question in the affirmative. This is an extreme position without legal support. That position ignores that courts have made clear that there is a qualified right of access, First Amendment right of access, in civil cases. Not only has every circuit that's taken up the issue held so, this court held that in the Del Papa case. The position of the proponents of secrecy also ignores the public interest in access. This court has already recognized that family court is a matter of the utmost public concern. Family court judges are elected like other judges in Nevada, and the public should be able to assess the conduct and performance of family court judges as much as possible. There's also a public interest in allowing the public to assess the in-court behavior of attorneys. This court held that in the Abrams case. The underpinning of all the First Amendment court access cases is the central idea that transparency helps foster trust in our legal system. The need to foster trust is perhaps greatest, not lesser, in family court. And that's so because there's so much distrust in family court. It's also so because so many people interact with the family court system, and it's also because there are so many pro se litigants in family court.
Ms. McCletchy, let me interrupt you
Sure.
for just a second there. So part of the analysis, at least in looking at the cases about access to courtrooms, looks at whether these proceedings or this type of proceedings has traditionally been open. And NRS 125.080 has, since at least 1931, apparently, in a divorce action, has allowed on demand of either party to have those proceedings be private. What does that, is that some indication that traditionally family proceedings have been closed? And how does that statute apply to our analysis?
Your Honor, the question isn't whether in Nevada the tradition has been open or closed divorce proceedings. And I would point out that the statute actually starts with a presumption of openness. Divorce proceedings are open until a litigant does request closure. The problem with the statute is it doesn't apply the proper test for disclosure, and it hamstrings a judge from applying the proper constitutional request and instead requires them to follow just the whim of a party. The United States Supreme Court in El Vocero DPR v. Puerto Rico made very clear that in terms of the history and of experience test, that Puerto Rico was wrong when it said that it was its own history that mattered. It's a national test. It goes back to the common law. And in fact, divorce proceedings and other family law proceedings have historically been open to the public. It's also important to point out that family law includes a huge swath of types of cases. In family law, these rules that work together, some cases are automatically secret and others are secret only upon the request of a single litigant.
Counsel, SCOTUS that decision has not been applied to family law ever. Is that right?
It is correct. The United States Supreme Court has not specifically addressed the question of the application to civil cases under the First Amendment. However, every single circuit that has considered the question has answered that question in the affirmative.
In the context of a civil case and not necessarily a particular in a family law context. I just want to distinguish between criminal, civil, and family law.
That's true. But family court is no different from other courts in important ways. First, the tradition is an element that courts look at, but the most important issue that courts look at in determining whether the First Amendment right of access applies is whether it helps foster good government to have transparency and to have access. And that the answer to that question in the context of family court is yes, just as much as in any other court.
Well, how do we balance the value in good government in this context against the families on the most personal, unfortunate sometimes matters related to their intimate relationships? How do we balance that? Is that really the best way to get at good government, would be to open up their proceedings unhindered?
We're not asking to open these proceedings unhindered. We're simply asking that family court judges, like other judges, apply the constitutional test. The United States Supreme Court considered a similar question in the Globe newspapers case. And in that case, the question was whether a blanket rule against closure regarding the testimony of child sex crime victims in Massachusetts, whether that could withstand constitutional scrutiny. Even when considering that issue, the United States Supreme Court said a blanket rule was unconstitutional. Courts can consider the privacy interests. They should consider the privacy interests, but they have to do it on a case-by-case basis. And the proponents of secrecy are not taking an extreme position that all family court matters should always be open in their entirety. Instead, just like in the Globe newspaper cases, the solution is that the judges are supposed to apply the constitutional test on a case-by-case basis. I did want to reserve some time for rebuttal, and I do have two other counsel to speak.
All right, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Sophia Romero on behalf of ACLU of Nevada for petitioner Mr. Falcone. To pick up on where my co-counsel left off, these rules do nothing to balance the competing interests of the parties and public. They do not allow for any findings of fact or conclusions of law, do not allow for any objection from the adverse party. If one party only wants it sealed and the other party does not allow for any objection, there's no appellate right, obviously. And so for any type of review to happen, it would have to be done on a writ. And there's no record to even review like an abuse of discretion or anything like that because there's no test applied here. Under the First Amendment, there's no legal distinction between family courts and civil courts, which is actually prohibited under Article 6, Section 14 of the Nevada Constitution. There's one civil action. Additionally, family courts are district courts, as the legislature has enacted it under NRS Chapter 3. Courts across the country, such as California, New York, Florida, have recognized that family matters have traditionally been open and require strict scrutiny analysis prior to closing, just like any other civil matter.
They've made that recognition. Has it been in their own states?
Excuse me?
They've traditionally been open in California, in New York, in the United States as a whole?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. So divorces have traditionally been open historically and going back to common
law. But not in Nevada.
Well, in Nevada, the presumption is that they're open unless a party requests that they be closed.
So are you calling that a history of openness of proceedings then?
Yes, because the actual hearing itself is open unless a party requests that it be closed.
Right.
So
right.
Unless there's a request.
We've had a statute that allows a party to request that the proceedings be closed since 1930 something.
Yes, but again, we're supposed to look at historically on a national scale, as the Supreme Court held in the Puerto Rico case. To be clear, our position is not that documents may never be redacted or filed under seal, or that a court can never close a hearing or a portion thereof. But that is the exception under the First Amendment rather than the rule, and it should be the exception here in Nevada. This matters fundamentally about the nature of courts as public institutions. Courts as public institutions belong to the public. The right of public access to the courts exists both in common law and by virtue of the First Amendment. The natures of the matters handled in family court department do not negate constitutional requirements. All courts handle sensitive information. PI cases have medical information, guardianship cases, probate cases. All courts handle sensitive information, and they do that in a way where they can balance the public interest without sealing the entire proceeding. We have SRCR Rule 3, which basically goes through the strict scrutiny analysis and provides guidance to the other district courts. Underneath that, in that section, it's family courts are excluded, but all the other district courts, all the other courts are supposed to follow that. So there is zero harm in conducting a case-by-case factual analysis under the correct level of scrutiny to balance the requesting party's privacy interest with the public's right to access. The potential harm of abuses in an arbitrarily closed courtroom are numerous and include not just the public's view of the court, but also include additional harms to those unrepresented and who already are disadvantaged.
Maybe explain that a little bit more, because it seems like to me what would happen is if litigants are required to make some higher level of findings to have their proceedings sealed, it would make it more difficult for self-represented litigants to keep things private if that's what worked for their family.
So with that, it would be... I don't think that it would necessarily be more difficult for pro se litigants, because pro se litigants actually, if they make the request, it is usually somebody who has either financial reasons, financial issues that they don't want to come out into the public, or there's type of domestic violence issues that they don't want to come out in the public. So someone who wants to seal the court usually has, privacy concerns like that. The other side doesn't necessarily, who would usually be the more indigent side or the victim of domestic violence, would not necessarily want the proceedings closed. But at least there would
might
be...
Might not the victim of domestic violence want to keep that secret and not necessarily have that kind of information
it's
out
possible,
in the world?
But under these rules, the victims of domestic violence are not even allowed to bring in a support system with them to a hearing to face their abuser. So, like, the siblings, the rules allows for siblings, parents, witnesses, the courts and staff and attorneys, right? But if someone doesn't have a parent or a sibling, they cannot bring their best friend with them to go face their abuser. And so that is where the problem lies. We can't, by statute, tell somebody who their support system can be if they're a victim of domestic violence. And I believe I'm out of time, but closing the courtroom is a government activity. The court rule mandating closure constitute a government activity. While the proponents of secrecy argue that these individuals are not in entities, they are still availing themselves to the public courtroom.
Let me just be clear. You're not opposed to the courtroom being closed in these proceedings as long as the judge makes findings that justify that.
Yes, it has to be a strict scrutiny analysis, and if they find that it satisfies strict scrutiny, then yes, the proceedings can be closed.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Luke Busby, appearing for petitioner Alexander Falcone. And I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. You've heard from my friends on the same side at length about how on their face EDCR 5.207 and EDCR 5.212 are unconstitutional. In the writ petition filed in case 85195, there is no distinction between the theory and practice of summarily excluding the press from certain family court matters. Central issue is whether there is something unique about family court that should exempt its rules and regulations from scrutiny under the First Amendment's right of access to court proceedings by the public and the press. And the answer is a resounding no. To recap the basic facts, my client, Mr. Falcone, filed a media request to provide electronic coverage under the Supreme Court rules in a proceeding involving the custody of children of an unmarried couple. On that same date, Mr. Minter, through his counsel, objected. The next day, the district court issued an order denying Mr. Falcone's petition. He cited a statute that relates to divorce only, but he also cited the EDCR rules that we're challenging here today. And that same day, we hustled and we got our emergency petition filed. Now, confidentiality orders closing court proceedings necessarily implicate First Amendment concerns. And open courts are the default position in American jurisprudence, and they have been since the beginning. Richmond Newspapers, 1980. Del Papa v. Steffen, in 1996, from this court. And Courthouse News, recently from the Ninth Circuit. They all conclude the same thing. Every court to consider the issue uniformly concludes that the right applies to both civil and criminal proceedings. No court has said that family court is special. And in fact, the most analogous situation to the facts presented before this court is the Globe newspaper case, in which a Massachusetts statute that by definition excluded from the press and the public testimony of a minor victim of a sex crime violates the First Amendment. Now, the court wasn't saying that we want to embarrass minor victims of sex crimes. What it was saying is that a rule that creates a categorical exclusion is unconstitutional because a categorical...
Counsel, hasn't our legislature always treated family cases as different and special? We have a variety of statutes that close different family proceedings that do not exist in the more traditional civil or criminal context.
That is the case, Your Honor. There is a long tradition in Nevada of the statutory exclusion originating in 1865. But the case law surrounding, and I'll make 2 points in response to that, the case law surrounding the constitutionality of excluding members of the press was really well developed in the Richmond Newspapers v. Virginia case. That's when the court made clear, hey, there's a First Amendment right of the press to access these proceedings. And the subsequent cases have developed in that direction ever since. And what's interesting is that it appears to us no one has ever challenged these statutes or the statutory scheme on this basis in Nevada. And Mr. Falcone, by virtue of what he does, is in a very unique position to bring such a challenge. Most family court cases aren't interesting to the press. They're typically matters between two private individuals. But Mr. Falcone has taken the power of the internet and harnessed that so that regular people can observe other regular people before courts in the state of Nevada. And so he's in a very unique position to bring that challenge after this long history of the existence of these rules. Now,
is it your position then that 125.080 is unconstitutional?
It is, Your Honor. We believe the Constitution creates a floor, which is that there has to be a compelling government interest, and if the court is to address that interest, the solution has to be narrowly tailored. That analysis cannot occur in the case of categorical exclusion, and that is exactly why, in Globe newspaper, the Supreme Court struck down the most analogous rule that we could find to the exclusion we have in Nevada. A strict scrutiny analysis cannot occur if there's a categorical exclusion because you can't narrowly tailor to protect the government's interest. Now, I can tell you in the criminal context, what my client does as a matter of practice, he's actually filmed a proceeding in which a sex crime victim testified at a sentencing, a minor. And what he did is he blurred out the person's face and didn't disclose their name. And I think everyone understands in the criminal context that there's no reason that isn't appropriate. And I don't think
it's well established in the criminal context that there's a First Amendment right to access. Do you agree that the government interest, as we again move across the spectrum from criminal to civil, then to the niche, to family, that the government interest wanes as we get to a particularly intimate and private matter among people?
It's interesting because you don't really have a government actor advocating for the privacy in this case.
You're asking for a First Amendment right to access.
Oh, we're saying that I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
The press itself has a First Amendment interest in accessing court proceedings. It's not just the interests of the parties that are at stake. It's the interest in the public in being able to see what occurs in family court proceedings and for the corrective mechanism that we have here in Nevada to operate. People can't vote for judges that they think are doing right or wrong things if they have no idea what's happening in family court proceedings. And very recently, in a recent past, there was some major issues with guardianship proceedings in Nevada. And those were addressed largely because the press wrote about it. Now, in this case, the unseen interest is the interest of the public at large and the voters who can't see these proceedings. And if there is a compelling government interest, such as the privacy of a minor in a case of a sex crime or something like that that's going to be discussed at family court, family court judges are capable of exercising the discretion permitted to them under the First Amendment to narrowly tailor a solution so that interest is protected. We're not asking for a black and white, open or not open situation here. We're saying there's a floor that the Constitution created. And Nevada has, through various statutes and regulations, fallen beneath that floor. And that's recognized in the reporters for the Reporters Committee for the Free Press, who basically said that Nevada has the most restrictive access provision to family court proceedings in the nation. And we looked through all of the materials cited on the other side, and we couldn't find a case or a law or a case anywhere that did the same thing in the same way that occurs in Nevada.
So, Counsel, I want to ask specifically about the EDCR 5.207, which I believe is one of the two rules explicitly being challenged in your petition. And basically what that said is that if you're involving custody or parentage between unmarried parties, we're going to treat it under the same chapter that we've been treating similar disputes between married parties. Is that, are we on the same page so far?
Yes, Your Honor. Strangely.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Let me finish and then I'll let you talk. So, and then by incorporating, I guess, or saying that those proceedings are going to be in accordance with Chapter 126, which has applied to married couples having disputes about custody and parentage issues, it sort of brought in, I guess, NRS 126.211, which since 1979 has said that any hearing or trial under this chapter must be held in closed court without admittance of anyone other than those necessary to the action or proceeding, and it goes on. So I guess, given that this is specifically relating to custody parentage issues under 126.211, which has been in place since 1979, how do your challenges apply to that?
Well, Your Honor, first I'd like to point out it's odd that Chapter 126 was integrated into this rule because custody disputes aren't always parentage disputes. And it actually makes the regulation 5.207 stronger than the rule that applies in a regular divorce proceeding. And it is the case that those types of situations have been closed, but again, it falls beneath the floor created by the First Amendment when it comes to press access request to review or view those proceedings.
In terms of 5.212, is it your interpretation? I think you might have alluded to it, or perhaps one of your colleagues, that 5.212, while having a similar provision to NRS 125.080, may be broader in that it extends beyond divorce proceedings. Can you tell me about that, or is that broader than the statute is?
Yeah, I believe EDCR 5.212 also applies in cases of custody disputes between unmarried couples. And it does provide a provision where a court can determine, in the best interest of justice for the child, whether third parties can remain to observe proceedings. And it also provides a provision saying that it's unlawful to distribute or discuss sealed records, which is also antithetical to the First Amendment in that it imposes a cost on speech about what occurs in family court. And with that, I'm burning up my co-counsel's time, and I greatly appreciate the court considering this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busby. Mr. Connor?
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Jeffrey Connor from the Nevada Attorney General's Office on behalf of the 8th Judicial District Court. At counsel's table with me is Marshall Willick from the Willick Law Group, who I will be splitting time with. I think there are three questions for the court to address in this case. First, obviously, because we are in a writ posture, this court has discretion to decide whether it would choose to issue a writ or not. And so deciding whether or not a writ is appropriate in these circumstances and whether the issue is appropriately presented to the court for adjudication is an issue for the court to resolve. Then, of course, we get to application of deciding whether or not the First Amendment creates a right of access at all, which has, you know, been the subject of discussion here, that there is a two-part test for determining when the First Amendment does create a right of public access to court proceedings. And then, depending on how the court resolves that question, and then how does what the court decides apply to these specific rules and statutes that are at issue here. I think that, you know, the discussion that has occurred here, for me, with the two-part test on deciding whether or not there is a First Amendment right of access is a central piece of this dispute. Historically speaking, yes, there is indications here that divorce and other domestic relations proceedings in Nevada are different. That there's statutory roots going all the way back to pre-statehood, recognizing the privacy interests of the litigants in domestic relations proceedings, and that there are different privacy interests at stake in those kinds of proceedings that courts don't always have to deal with in other contexts.
So is the analysis of the First Amendment right of access limited to what that history is in Nevada specifically? Is there a different First Amendment right in Nevada than there is in California or another state?
I think that's an interesting question. Of course, if this court chose to address this question under the Nevada Constitution, it could do that and focus on Nevada history.
I don't think that's the challenge today.
The First Amendment question, though, I think probably is going to look at a broader context than just the state. But I think there is authority that this court can look to that addresses that issue. The Nixon versus Warner communications case from the United States Supreme Court, before there was an established First Amendment right of access under the Globe case, recognized that public access to divorce proceedings in a case out of Rhode Island that was decided in the 1890s recognized that oftentimes the privacy interests of litigants in domestic relations proceedings forces the common law right of access to court records to bow to those privacy interests. And so there is a demonstration in authority elsewhere other than Nevada that these sorts of proceedings involve private matters that are not of a public interest. The other thing that I would say,
you're saying that nationally there's a tradition of closing these type of proceedings?
Even
if we look beyond Nevada, standard would be met.
There is support for that proposition, and I would point the court to the In re Caswell case that cited. This court cited that case in a 1906 case. I can't remember the name of the case off the top of my head, but it's cited in the family law section's amicus brief in the Minter case. Cited that case for recognizing that there's not a strong public interest in the disputes that occur in the family law setting.
Why shouldn't that be on a case by case basis and analyzed? So if there's some specific reason that
I think
there should be protected here.
I think there's a very strong recognition that family law is different and that the kinds of privacy interests that are at stake are present in virtually every family law case. And that can be recognized by, I think, the misplaced recognition in some of the briefing on this court's rules on redaction and sealing of court records. If you look at Rule 1, on the scope of those rules, specifically excludes all domestic relations proceedings from this court's rules on sealing and redaction of records, meaning that the family court doesn't have to go through the process that's required by all of those rules to seal or redact court records.
Mr. Connor, if I could, let's assume hypothetically that the hearings are open. If they're presumptively open, would you agree that there does become a judicial obligation to make findings as to why they should be closed, why something should be kept private?
I think that's true if you determine that if there's a First Amendment right of access here. But I think the cases that predate the recognition of a First Amendment right of public access to court proceedings, the common law test is just a balancing test of whether or not the privacy interest outweighs the public interest the public's interest in access to the proceeding. So
why should we be relying on the cases that predate the recognition of the First Amendment right of access?
I haven't seen in any of the briefing a common law challenge raised here. So if the court decides that the First Amendment doesn't create a right of access here, I don't think you need to go beyond that. But that, you know, so let, that let's is a secondary let's assume, issue.
Let's assume that the court believes there is a First Amendment access, and then that there is a presumption that the hearings are open. Would the judge then need to make findings before they could close or make private particular aspects of a hearing?
Yes, I believe that that's what the case law would require here, is that if there is a First Amendment right
so
of access.
So my next question is, and it was brought up, I believe, by Ms. McCletchie, as well as maybe Ms. Romero and Mr. Busby, but the nature of Rule 5.212 seems to me to speak to hearings being presumptively open, but only closed when, upon demand of a party, it's asked that the hearing be private.
Correct. That's where, and Mr. Busby addressed this, there, subsection D of Rule 5.212 specifically gives the district court the authority to consider the interests of justice or the best interest of a child in determining whether any person should be excluded from that proceeding. And that any person isn't limited to the people that are listed in subsection B of the rule, that even in a situation where the proceeding is closed, there's there's a list of persons that presumptively cannot be excluded and can only be excluded on a written motion of a party under C.
Understood, but there's a very important semantic difference between something that is by law closed and something that is by law closable.
Correct.
If it's closable, it seems to me that it's presumed open, and then it's closable if the law is followed in terms of making the particular findings. And a second part of that I want you to address is, when we talk about traditionally whether things are closed or not, are we focusing on whether the law makes it mandatorily closed, or the practice of judges and attorneys over the course of time has been to close things even though the law may show that they're presumptively open?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, Your Honor. That is a point here where it does seem like the old statute at least required a request from one of the parties that the proceeding be closed. But I don't know that necessarily created a presumption of public access. It demonstrates that just an individual party could request that it be closed. And nothing more needed to be shown at that point than just a mere request from one of the parties that it be made private. And I think the other thing that I would point out in terms of applying the two-prong test that the Supreme Court has established is that even if the first prong is satisfied, they also have to satisfy the second prong. And I think that, to me, is where I have a very real concern about the questions the court posed about protection of pro se parties in these sorts of proceedings, which is, if a pro se litigant has to make a showing that's going to satisfy strict scrutiny in order to seal a proceeding that invariably is going to involve significant types of private information. And, I mean, there's the obvious context of, in the Minter case, there's medical records, psych records, financial information. Those are obvious cases, but let me pose a hypothetical where I think that really brings this light to me. A very common term in divorce decrees is that a parent either needs the other parent's permission or a court order in order to take their children outside of the jurisdiction. If a mother wants to take her children to see their grandparents in Utah and her ex-spouse refuses to consent to that, she has to go to the court order to court to get an order saying, yes, you can take your children to Utah between this date and this date. If that all becomes public information, that's a wide open advertisement to the public that she's going to be gone and her home could be burglarized.
Aren't there things like that in civil and criminal cases all the time, and they're appropriately addressed?
I don't know that's so commonly happens in civil cases where that's a very common thing that happens all the time in dealing with child custody. The other thing that I did want to point out that Justice Kadish had some questions about 5.207. A parentage action under Chapter 126 was created in 1979 and to use kind of outdated terminology, it was a paternity action, right? So that was an action that always involved unmarried parties. What historically has over time happened and become practice in the 8th Judicial District Court is that sometimes where the issue of who the biological parents of a child aren't in dispute, they can jump past that and get straight to the custody issues. And that and sometimes has been referred to in the 8th Judicial District Court as a custody action. But it's really just a short form of a parentage action because there's no dispute over the issue of who the parents of the children are. And so that's really, and that's what to me, like when you look at 5.207, just a straight challenge to that rule itself, all that does is say a custody dispute between unmarried parents is a parentage action under Chapter 126. The First Amendment has nothing to say about how Nevada classifies or what it calls a particular kind of action.
No, but arguably it has something to say about whether the public has access.
Only when you go to Chapter or to NRS 126.211, which then makes the proceeding confidential. The rule itself doesn't make anything confidential. Only the statutes within the chapter that the rule says apply, right, is there then.
So are you saying the rule did not expand the kind of proceedings that 126.211 applied to?
No, technically no. I mean, other than the fact that there has been sort of this practice in the 8th Judicial District with creating what's been called a parentage or a custody action, which is a shortened form of a parentage action, simply because the parties were stipulating to who the parents were.
I'm not trying to be difficult with this question, I promise. Are you saying that this EDCR 5.207, in this particular context, that it expanded the scope of proceedings subject to 126.211 or did not expand
the scope? No, it's taking things that have always traditionally been handled under Chapter 126 and putting them where they belong, which is under 126. It's okay. That they've just started calling it a custody action, okay, when what it really is a parentage action where there's just not a dispute about who the parents are.
Are you arguing that in those types of actions there is any different interest in privacy that would overcome First Amendment rights as distinct from other domestic cases, divorce cases, other family law cases?
Yes, I do think that the blanket confidentiality in those types of proceedings comes back to when you look at the origins of that statute is really about addressing stigma that was imposed upon children that were born out of wedlock, and that it. Keeping that sort of information private is very important to children that are the subject of those kinds of proceedings. And so that's where I think the interest in that blanket closure comes from. So I'd like to defer the rest of my time to Mr. Willock and allow him to address the court.
Thank you, Mr. Conner.
Madam Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willock for Amicus, American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers, authorized to speak for both real parties in interest, Mr. Minter and Ms. Easley. May it please the court. I have received that authorization from both counsel. I'm sorry, I've never been objected to during oral argument.
Proceed.
Thank you. Every state in the union has some process or procedure for restricting access to information, including some family court records or hearings or both, and each does so a little bit differently. The great majority restrict automatically all access to paternity parentage actions as a matter of, and it's a good thing they do because it's a matter of federal mandate. under federal law, the Social Security Act specifically. The result of this case could be as simple as saying that, and I'd like to answer your question particularly, all custody actions, that's shorthand for the custody piece of a paternity case. That's all it is. Parties are allowed to skip appointment of a guardian ad litem and the other steps if they stipulate to paternity. All that rule does substantively is say that the court at the first hearing has to acknowledge that they did so. That's it. It's only
sorry, so they have
it
to,
did not expand the scope of cases applicable under 126. It merely recognized those cases for what they always have been since the early 1990s. The family court judges simply did away with the procedures that were useless to save parties a bunch of time and money. Where the parties stipulated a paternity, they don't need a guardian ad litem, they don't need a paternity test, they don't have to do all that stuff because they both agree on who the parents are. So all it does is recognize something that's always been true. But the point is that every state does it differently. Some states have stuff closed automatically. Frankly, our opponents are simply wrong. Some states have stuff presumptively. Some states require two parents to stipulate to close things, others one. Some states call for other procedures or tests or hearings or findings, and some don't. The states are literally free to do whatever they want. The point
Within the limits of the First Amendment.
Yeah, the point, sure. But the point is that within the scope of American law, there is no doubting the power of the Nevada legislature to dictate the benefits and burdens and who goes forward and who doesn't for who, what proceedings are open or closed and who has the burden of changing it. The Nevada legislature favored privacy and made it the burden of those who would invade that privacy to move to do so. This court has agreed for 100 years. It said so in Grimes in 1906 and in Johansson in 2008. This is the national norm under which a newspaper obtains access only if it, quote, demonstrates a legitimate interest for some useful purpose. That's the law review articles that were cited. The three writ petitions frame a false dispute and start with a false foundation. This case is not Mr. Falcone versus Nevada or Clark County or the Clark County Family Court. This case asks the question of whether Mr. Minter and Miss Easley's interest in protecting their privacy and the privacy of their child is trumped by Mr. Falcone's interest to invade that interest. And the answer to that question is no. The correct starting place is Article 1.
But the court didn't have to make findings about that.
No. The finding is subsumed in the request itself because of Article 1, Section 1 of the Nevada Constitution, which says that the liberty interest of every individual, of which the right to privacy is a, quote, immutable part, says is an unalienable right. The right to privacy is an individual and fundamental right going back to Justice Brandeis in 1897. It's built into the Nevada Constitution. That fundamental liberty right, recognized in Nevada since 1865, granting each citizen the right to control his or her own private information by closing divorce laws.
Let me ask you, if I might, Mr. Willick, a question. This is Justice Herndon. Mechanically in the family court, how does the demand take place? Do you file a written notice of a demand that you want something to be private under Rule 2.12? Is it made orally in court at the first appearance? How does that work?
If you're talking about sealing files, it's a matter of a written form. We designed it for the self-help centers. It's an easy form to do. If you're talking about closing a hearing, and I'm sorry, but both are at issue here. If we're talking about closing a hearing, it's usually an oral demand at the time of the beginning of the hearing.
Okay.
So that's the practical way of getting it. By the way, we're dealing with very few cases. Very few litigants, less than 10%, invoke either the right. So the complaints about educating the public or monitoring judicial behavior are nonsense. You can easily do
so. That was a follow-up question that I wanted to make, which was under Rule 5.212, assuming neither side makes such a demand, is that hearing then open to the public?
Yes. In the virtual world, it works exactly the way it did when everybody had to walk into a courtroom. If nobody says anything or does anything, anybody can walk in the door. So, yes, it's the default is that nobody cares unless somebody says something. It is an individual right to be invoked. It's worth stressing that it's the litigant's choice here, not the judges. They don't care. And not the attorneys, who are not relevant. This is an individual right of individual parties under the Nevada Constitution and going back to the United States Constitution. The writ petitions have it backwards. Reporters have no greater rights of access than the public, according to this court's rules. And to invade an individual's fundamental right to privacy, they have to show good cause to do it. Under a host of laws, lots of information is absolutely protected, including personal identifying information in medical and educational records, including the names on those records. That is personal identifying information. Mr. Falcone is not only not permitted to broadcast that information, he's not allowed to be in the room to hear it. Under Troxell, parents have a fundamental liberty interest in raising their children. Mr. Minter and Ms. Easley have the right to prevent any person, from gaining any information about their child's educational, psychiatric, psychological, or medical conditions. They certainly have the right to prevent that information from being the subject of a YouTube video for the amusement of their child's classmates. What these writ petitions seek is to break the lock on the bedroom door, assert that no one has a right to keep their own personal private information private. They want, Justice Perigary, to say that you have no right to seal your divorce case. They know everything
counsel, respectfully, that's not true, because as in civil and criminal proceedings, there could be a request to seal it or keep it private, and then the court would have to make the appropriate findings.
The writ petitions before us say that those statutes and the rules encompassing and applying them need to be swept away,
right.
Invalidated. As a matter of, they say automatically unconstitutional. They don't say why. They don't actually give any authority for it. But they want to say that every piece of paper in every divorce file has to be completely open to the public, true or false, right or wrong, private and personal, not allowed to be disclosed or not.
Why should divorce cases be different?
Because
treated differently than civil and criminal cases.
They always have been, and they are analytically different under the law because the information that is in those cases is information that is not allowed to be disclosed. And they're in every case. It applies across case types. The Court of Appeals just affirmed an annulment case of mine and called Land. We spent the entire trial talking about my client's medical condition. His HIPAA-protected medical condition. Okay. No individual is allowed to learn.
Are you under the impression that there aren't civil cases about medical conditions?
Probably some, but that's not my problem. I'm working in family court where every case type involves this information at every hearing. It's universal. There are essentially no hearings in which that doesn't go forward. Executives, prosecutors, and others justifiably fear that their personal, private, identifying information will make them very easy targets for revenge, for kidnapping, for extortion. I mean, doesn't anybody remember Kevin Wynn? The kidnapper's lawyer in that case claimed that it was just business. Likewise, Mr. Falcone probably has no interest in facilitating identity theft, child kidnapping, it's just business. If he gets more clicks, he gets more money. By broadcasting the most lurid and salacious matters possible, no matter what the privacy interests are of the victims. I'm not done, but my clock has expired.
You have five more minutes.
The United States Supreme Court has held that the First Amendment does not guarantee the press any constitutional right of access to information not available to the public generally. Justice Brennan put it this way, the right to speak and publish does not carry with it the right to gather information. Unlimited voyeurism does nothing to prevent the kind of cognitive bias or incompetence that's talked about in some of the briefs, specifically the Laxon brief. If the problem is judicial competence or integrity, alter judicial selection and alter judicial training. But we would not get better paternity rulings by turning every hearing into a televised episode of Who's Your Daddy? It's not going to improve anything judicially. The Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press asked two questions, that case, asked two questions. Whether the proceeding has historically been open and whether free access is essential for the judicial process. Both are required to get a constitutional right of access under the First Amendment. And neither is true here. We've given you the cases going back to the 1800s from the Eastern Seaboard to the Western Seaboard. The states are allowed to form their own rules. Closed and restricted access to these matters has been the rule since before Nevada was a state and in other states before then. Nevada has struck a good balance, a reasonable balance between privacy and access, unlike many states who have automatic or presumptive closure to a lot more kinds of proceedings than we do. That study they cited is simply wrong. They completely ignore the states that have automatic closure of matters. Nothing is closed here or sealed here at the behest of the government. It's an individual right, your right, my right, the right of each party to each one of these cases. Do we really want a reality where the general public hears the accusations and sees the medical records of who gave herpes to who when? Is that the world we want to create here? Medical, educational, and lots of other records contain what's identified as personal identifying information that includes the names on the records. And it's required to be kept private. That information is in every single family court case. All of them. Every case type. Names, pet names, utility accounts, Social Security numbers, mother's maiden name, it's all required to be kept confidential under Nevada law and under federal law, and it's in every single family court filing. By the rules of this court, you require people to give all that information. How much less likely are people to give that information if they think it's going to be broadcast to the whole world? It's hard enough to get anything done in family court reliably. It certainly would not make it any easier if people's most personal and private information was being constantly revealed to the world, both in writing and at the hearings. And for the RJ to say they want contemporaneous access, so there's no opportunity to even monitor whether or not there's been a violation, would make it 10 times worse, because there's no way to fix it. Somebody says something in violation of HIPAA, too bad, it's gone. It's been broadcast to the universe. The bad guys are out there. We see them every day. They just need open and easy access to information to act. And this court should not make it any easier for the protection of lots of innocent parties. The Federal Social Security Act requires protecting privacy in all paternity cases. That's been a federal weighing of burdens and benefits. It's required. That's why all the paternity statutes in all the cases that we cited, the great majority of states, maybe 30, require those cases to be sealed and closed automatically. That's why 126 exists the way it is. As our legislature said in NRS 425.405, it's required for our 4D funding to do this by federal law. The FERPA, the Family and Educational Rights and Privacy Act of 1974, prohibits disclosures of any of a minor's educational records or any personally identifiable information without a specific court order. So there's your First Amendment way. The federal government has decided they have to show good cause and get a court order to get access to any of that information. You don't get to walk in and broadcast it. My time is up, but I'll gladly answer any other questions you might have.
Hearing none. All right, thank you, counsel. Ms. McClatchy, are you next? Oh, I'm sorry, who's next? If you've got it figured out, then perfect.
Madam Chief Justice, our clocks aren't working here. Can you tell me how much rebuttal time is left for the appellants, for the petitioners?
6 minutes, 54 seconds.
Thank you very much.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, Sophia Romero, I just have a couple points. So the 1891 treatise acknowledged that in the ordinary practice, the right of public access extends to divorce cases, and that was in common law. The access test is the same whether it's dealing with criminal or civil matters. Again, litigants can be influenced by their attorneys requesting the seal, and we've all seen that there are history of abuses in the family courts. People who are in the family court system, again, are availing themselves to a public court. Second part of the access test, there are absolute public reasons why it's a benefit to have public access. The Supreme Court has routinely held public access serves to promote trustworthiness of the judicial process, to curb judicial abuses, and to provide the public with a more complete understanding of the judicial system, including a better perception of its fairness. And that's out of the Ninth Circuit. But anyway, and again, for the privacy interests, and this court has held in Logan D that the privacy interests of the party were not a fundamental interest, but the First Amendment right to access is a fundamental interest. And the test was applied in Logan D by this court regarding privacy. There was a long privacy analysis. And even though that was a criminal case, it was a juvenile criminal case, so it was held in the family court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief. First of all, I don't think any court has created a substantive due process liberty interest right to a closed court proceeding. Secondly, regarding indigent parties, the legal aid, amici, addressed that issue thoroughly. If anybody's qualified to speak to that issue, it's them. Three, money. Mr. Falcone doesn't make money doing this. He loses money. I'm here pro bono. This is not an issue about money. The argument that we're requesting absolute access to court proceedings is a straw man. We're certainly not. We're just asking for the courts to take back the discretion that's required under the Constitution. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Just a few points. There's been a lot of discussion today about whether what rules and statutes have been in place for in Nevada over history. But courts and states can't write themselves out of the Constitution. And the two-part test, the Supreme Court in El Vocero rejected the exact same argument that Mr. Willick is making today and said that it's Puerto Rico can't rely on their own history to say the preliminary hearings are closed to the public. So it's a long history, it's a national history, and while Mr. Willick cites the cases that predate Richmond, it's just not the case that divorce is closed across this country. In fact, divorce and family law proceedings are often open. There is no case after Richmond where they have held that there's some sort of closure. CNC arguably suggests there can be some sort of blanket closure to family court. That case is very old from another state, and it predates Richmond. They can't cite to a single case that has upheld the idea that there can be the kind of blanket or one-party closure. All of the interests they claim today can be protected by a judge pursuant to the constitutional test that applies. They rely on dicta from Nixon that, again, predates the Richmond case in which the Supreme Court announced the First Amendment right in that instance to criminal cases. But in every instance, courts that have considered the issue have made clear that the right of access also applies in civil proceedings. Family court, I understand, it involves private issues. It can involve statutes to protect certain information, as Mr. Willick has pointed out. But it is not different from other courts in that regard. In Globe newspapers, the United States Supreme Court rejected exactly the type of rule that the proponents of secrecy are arguing for today, and that is that courts can find that compelling interest of protecting child sex victims is so important that the press can be blanketly held out, shut out of court. Instead, what the United States Supreme Court said is what this court should say today, and that's that the constitutional strict scrutiny analysis simply needs to be applied on a case-by-case basis. Other district courts do this all the time. For example, personal injury cases involve medical records. I represent a woman who is a rape victim. That includes sensitive information in district court. Courts do routinely, in the both civil and criminal context, protect sensitive information. With regard to the idea the focus on tradition and the common law. I've explained why the Alvocero case makes that argument without merit. However, the most important prong of the analysis is the function. And the proponents of secrecy are advocating such an extreme position that they would have this court believe that there is no public interest in access to information about family court. While it was not an access to court case, this court held the exact opposite in the Abrams case. It held that what happens in family court is a matter of the utmost public concern. It is. Family court judges do deal with extremely important and personal issues in people's lives, such as whether they have custody over their own children. Those decisions are not made by a jury. That fact is not a reason for less transparency. It's a reason for more. We have one person making decisions over people's lives. That one person is accountable to the voters. And while family court certainly can be closed in part, according to the constitutional standard, hearings can be closed, testimony can be closed, records can be redacted. The public should have as much access to information as possible. The idea that anybody is trying to get this information and disseminate it so that they can embarrass people, this parade of horribles, it doesn't happen in other cases, and doesn't happen in civil cases routinely, and it is not the point. The point is that when information needs to be protected, district court judges should exercise their discretion. Individual family litigants do not have a constitutional right to privacy to unilaterally decide what is closed in family court.
Thank you, Ms. McClatchy.
Thank you.
All right, this matter will stand submitted. Council, thank you.